We're beginning a series for Advent on Christmas carols. Who wrote them? When were they written? And why did they write them? And looking at some of the incredible theology in them. Often when it comes to Christmas carols, because they're so familiar, we just kind of sing them without thinking about what we're singing. And I encourage you to take time to really think about what we're singing, because it's pretty incredible. The carol that I've chosen to speak on today is one that gets my attention every time we sing it. It's because the lyrics speak so profoundly about the mission and the identity of Jesus Christ. The title of the Christmas carol is We Three Kings of Orient Are. Or there is an alternative title, which I like even better, The Quest of the Magi. It was written in 1857 by an Episcopalian pastor by the name of John Hopkins. He wrote it for a Christmas pageant in New York City. So let me read some of the lyrics. We three kings of Orient are, bearing gifts we travel so far, field and fountain, moor and mountain, following yonder star. And in the chorus, O star of wonder, star of light, star with royal beauty bright, westward leading, still proceeding, guide us with thy perfect light. And of course, the background for that carol is Matthew chapter 2. And so I want to read those verses for us this morning, and then we'll talk about it. Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea during the reign of King Herod. About that time, some men from eastern lands arrived in Jerusalem asking, "Where is the newborn king of the Jews? We saw his star as it rose, and we have come to worship him." King Herod was deeply disturbed when he heard this, as was everyone in Jerusalem. So he called a meeting of the leading priests and teachers of religious law and asked, "Where is the Messiah to be born?" "In Bethlehem in Judea," they replied, "for this is what the prophet wrote. And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are not least among the ruling cities of Judah. For a ruler will come from you who will be the shepherd for my people." Then Herod called for a private meeting with the wise men, and he learned from them the time when the star first appeared. Then he told them, "I want you to go to Bethlehem and search carefully for the child, and when you find him, come back and tell me so that I can come and worship him too." After this interview, the wise men went on their way, and when the star they had seen in the east guided them to Bethlehem, it went ahead of them and stopped over the place where the child was. And when they saw the star, they were filled with joy. And they entered the house and saw the child with his mother. And they bowed down and worshipped him. And then they opened their treasure chest and gave him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. As we read this account, I want you to stop and think what this passage tells us about the Magi, or the wise men. And it's a little bit different from the Christmas carol. Most people automatically, when asked, they would say that there are three Magi. Why? Because there were three gifts. But Matthew never actually tells us that there were three Magi. It just uses the plural. There were more than one Magi. There could have been two, there could have been five, there could have been seven, there could have been a dozen. We really don't know. But we do know that they brought three separate gifts with them. Also, the carol mentions that they were kings, three kings of the Orient. But in Matthew's gospel, they're never called kings. There are two kings that are talked about, Herod and Jesus, but not the Magi. They are called, in the translation we read this morning, wise men or Magi. So let's focus a little bit on them. Who were they? Well, they're not kings, even though they were people of great respect. Again, tradition tells us that there were three, and it's even given them three names, Caspar, Balthazar, and Melchior. However, those names were given centuries after the fact, never mentioned in Scripture. Interestingly, in the 12th century, the Bishop of Cologne, Germany, actually claimed to have found the skulls of the three wise men. Why? Because he was building a brand new, magnificent cathedral, a Gothic cathedral that you can visit today. It's absolutely magnificent. And to make this cathedral even more magnificent, he wanted to have a shrine to the Magi. And you can go today and visit the shrine to the Magi, which he claimed had their bones. He wanted more relics to make his church more famous, but again, there is no evidence that these bones are actually the bones of the three Magi. And so, they weren't kings. We're not told there were three, and we don't even know if they rode on camels, even though every nativity scene that you see has them riding on camels. So where did they come from? Well, they came from the east, our eastern lands. So I knew you would need a map this morning. I didn't want to disappoint Fraser. So on this map, you can see Jerusalem, and you can see Damascus to the north of it, and you can see the east. Well, to the east is the Arabian Desert. But if you go beyond that, you have Persia, you have Babylon, you have Susa, you have the kingdom of the Persian Empire. And most scholars believe that's where they came from. But you could not go as the crow flies because you can't go through the Arabian Desert with caravan. There's no water. It is totally desolate. So you would have to follow the Fertile Crescent by going north, and then you would have to come back south back into Jerusalem. So as a crow flies, it's about 500 miles or 800 kilometers. But if you go by caravan, you have to go around the Arabian Desert. So that adds another 200 miles. So that makes the trip about 4 months long in distance. That's a long way to travel. Most likely they came again from the Persian Empire, and they would have been skilled in philosophy, ancient medicine, natural sciences, and of course in astronomy. Many of the Magi of the Far East were also into astrology, making them soothsayers and fortune tellers and people of magical arts who frequently turned into charlatans. But not so with these Magi. They were intrigued by the stars. And notice it says, when they arrived in Jerusalem in verse 2, the first question they ask is, where is the one who was born? The newborn. We've seen the star. And we have come to worship him. And what about the star? Well, the star guided them somehow to Bethlehem. And then after they came to, actually they went to Jerusalem, and it went ahead of them, stopped over the place where the child was. And when they saw the star, it says they were filled with joy. Now, let me just talk a little bit about the background to all of this. Historically, there was a widespread expectation of a coming Messiah, one who would be a great deliverer, one who would be a great king. There is a Roman historian by the name of Suetius who wrote at the time of Christ, and I quote, "There had spread over all the East," which is where they were from, "an established belief that someone from Judea," which is the country where Jerusalem is located, "that someone from Judea would come and rule over the world." And that wasn't written by a Jewish historian. That's a Roman historian. There's another Roman historian by the name of Decius who wrote, and I quote, "There was a firm persuasion that at this time, rulers would come from Judea who would establish a universal empire." Interesting, he said rulers, plural. Not just one. And then, of course, there was Josephus, the famous Jewish historian. In his book entitled Jewish Wars, that was written at the same time as Christ's birth, he said that the Jews believed that a Messiah from their own country would soon come who would be the ruler of the world, the deliverer of the people, of the Jews. So that helps us understand that even though they were living in the Far East, they would be aware of a king who was to be born west of them. And that would help explain the reason for interpreting the star as they did. Also, there were still Jews from the Babylonian exile that were living in the Far East. They never all return back to Judea. And so they would have had the scriptures that contained the promise of the Messiah. So that may have been some of the background to them understanding this as well. What about the star? Well, there's a lot of speculation about what the star was. Often you read in the newspaper, some astronomer has come up with a theory that it was a comet, or it was the planet Jupiter that was shining brightly that year, or maybe there was some other phenomena in the sky that they interpreted as a star. Let me pause and just say, I don't think these things are accurate. I have a different theory altogether. I believe that these magi received a special revelation from God concerning what they were, where they were supposed to go, the star that they were supposed to follow, and even the gifts that they were to bring when they came, because each one of those things had incredible significance that they would not have been able to understand on their own. I also believe that the star was not a natural phenomenon. I believe it was a supernatural manifestation of the glory of God. I believe that the brilliance of the light as it appeared to the Magi as a star was similar to what we read in the Old Testament. Remember when the children of Israel left Egypt? In the book of Exodus, it says they were led by a pillar of light. And wherever they went, this pillar of light went, and God led them by following the pillar of light. And even after they crossed the Red Sea and went into the wilderness, that pillar of light went before them. And when they built the tabernacle, we read in Exodus chapter 40, that the pillar of light, the Shekinah presence of God, filled the tabernacle, and Moses wasn't even able to go into the tabernacle because the light was so brilliant and so radiant. And so I kind of believe that this was kind of the same thing, that the star that the Magi followed was the same resplendent, glorious Shekinah presence of God. And it's interesting, it says in verse 9 of Matthew chapter 2 that the star went ahead of them and it stopped right over the place where the child was. So that can't be something that's way up in the sky. That has to be something that is directly in front of them. And so that's another reason I would believe it was the Shekinah glory of God's presence. And they just followed it right to the place where Jesus was. Now, as we go back to Matthew chapter 2, when the Magi appeared, they said, "Where is the newborn King of the Jews? We have seen his star as it rose, and we have come to worship him." And then we read right after that that Herod wasn't too happy about this. It says, "He was deeply disturbed when he heard this, as was everyone in Jerusalem." Now, maybe I should give you a little bit of information about Herod and why he was so deeply disturbed about this star and these Magi who came. There's a number of Herods that are mentioned in the New Testament, and it's a bit confusing because sometimes we mix them up. This is Herod the Great that it's talking about here in Matthew chapter 2. He ruled over Palestine from about 40 BC right up until the birth of Jesus. He died shortly after that. And he became known, one of the things he became known as was Herod the Great, because he was a builder like nobody else. The guy was absolutely phenomenal. He built one of the seven wonders of the world, of the ancient world, which was the temple in Jerusalem. It's incredible. You can go there today and you can see some of the foundation stones are 46 feet long, 10 feet high, and 4 feet wide. How do you pick one of those suckers up? But he created the technology to do it. He also built the whole city of Caesarea Maritima and built a port there that the Romans used to come into Palestine. It was the first place where cement was poured underwater. Herod figured it out. He also built, get this, at least 8 palaces. I mean, one summer home wasn't enough. He had 8 of them, and at every one, he had a swimming pool, he had Roman baths, and incredibly decorated. He was the one who built Masada, which some of you have heard about. And you can still see how beautiful his palace was in Masada and the decorations of it. That's Herod the Great. And if you ever go to Israel, you will see some of the stuff that he did. But he was also an egomaniac. He was insanely jealous, and the older he got, the more paranoid he became. He was afraid that someone would want his position and power. And as he got older, he thought others were trying to dethrone him. So he had the Jewish high priest of Jerusalem, Aristobulus, who happened to be his wife's brother, murdered by drowning him. Interestingly, after that, he provided a magnificent funeral for the now dead high priest, and he pretended to mourn his loss. He had at least 10 different wives. His favorite wife was Mariamne. But toward the end of his life, he had her killed along with two of their children, their sons, because he was afraid they wanted to take over his kingdom. He also proceeded to kill her mother. After he executed two of his own sons, he then, on his deathbed, 5 days before he died, had a third son executed because he thought he was going to take over his throne. One of the greatest evidences of his cruelty is on his death, he had ordered his soldiers to round up 70 of prominent Jewish leaders from all over Palestine, take them to Jericho, put them in the hippodrome, and when he died, they were to be executed because he knew that the Jewish people would not mourn for him, but he wanted them to mourn, and they would mourn over these 70 prominent Jewish leaders. That's Herod. Of course, he also happened to be the one who had the male babies in Bethlehem executed because he was 2 years and under. So, this is the Herod who is deeply troubled. And it tells us that all Jerusalem was troubled with him. Why were they troubled? They were troubled because Herod was troubled and they never knew what he was going to do next. So Herod calls his religious leaders together. And in verse 3, he asks them the question, where is the Messiah supposed to be born? Notice their response, in Bethlehem in Judea, for this is what the prophet wrote. Who was the prophet? It was the prophet Micah. If you go to Micah 5:2, you will find these words that are quoted here in Matthew chapter 2. And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are not least among the ruling cities of Judah, for a ruler is going to come out of you who will be shepherd for my people Israel. Now, if you were to read that in the book of Micah, it also goes on to say, whose origins are from eternity past. That's another part that isn't included here in Matthew. But this ruler that's going to be born is going to rule over my people, and his origins are from eternity past. That's quite a prophecy. So they knew the prophecy. They quote it. And so what does Herod do? Herod has a private meeting with the wise men, and he learned from them the time when the star first appeared. If you were to read that in the original Greek, it says he learned from them, he wanted to know the exact time, the exact date when that star appeared, because Herod was trying to figure out the time frame in which this baby would have been born so he could eliminate them, and that's what he did afterwards. When he told them, he decided that he would eliminate all the babies, baby boys in Bethlehem area, 2 years of age and under. And that's exactly what he did. And then it says, when you find him, I want you to come back and tell me so that I can worship him as well. Again, that wasn't true. Herod was being deceitful. If he wanted to worship the newborn king of the Jews so badly, he should have gone with him, but he doesn't. And all the while, he's plotting to get rid of this newborn king of the Jews. Well, we read in verse 9 that what do they do after the interview? The wise men went on their way, and the star they had seen in the east guided them to Bethlehem. It went ahead of them and stopped right over the place where the child was. And again, that's why I suggest that this wasn't some phenomenon way up in the heavens. This star was going, a light that was going directly in front of them, because it stopped at the very place, at the very house where the child was. And again, it's a beautiful scene. They come into Bethlehem. These magi who had traveled perhaps a 1,000 kilometers over a period of months. And now they're at the end of their journey, and they find the newborn king that God had supernaturally been guiding them to. And it says they came to a house. And when they saw the star, the next verse, they were filled with joy, and they entered the house and saw the child. The reason I point this out is the word that is used in the Greek is oikios, for house. It's not a manger. It's not a stable. We have nativity scenes that we see all the time where the magi are there at the birth of Jesus. No, they were not there at the birth of Jesus. The shepherds were, but not the magi. They came later because they were busy traveling. And by the time they came, Jesus was no longer an infant, because it says they came and they saw the child. The Greek word for child is totally different than the word that is used here. The word that is used here is paideion, not the word for infant, refuse, but paideion. Maybe Jesus was by now 6 months of age, even a year. That's why Herod had all the children in Bethlehem under the age of 2 killed, because of the time of the star. So they entered the house, they saw the child. Notice it says, with his mother Mary. Matthew carefully guards the virgin birth of Jesus by not mentioning his father, really his stepfather at this point, because his father is actually God himself. And look at the response of the Magi in verse 11. And I love how it puts this. They entered the house, they saw the child and his mother Mary, and they bowed down and they worshiped him. And they opened their treasure chest, and they gave him gifts of gold and frankincense and myrrh. Those three gifts have incredible significance. And again, this is one of the reasons I believe that God had given them divine revelation, because they would have never known to bring these gifts without God somehow communicating with them that these were appropriate gifts to give this newborn king of the Jews. The first gift that they brought was what? It was gold. We're never told how much it was. Why did they bring gold? Because gold was a gift that was fit for a king. It was a gift for royalty. Most royal thrones are gilded with gold. Most royal crowns are covered with gold. It is the precious metal that is fit especially for one who is king. And that's what the second stanza of We Three Kings says. Born a king on Bethlehem's plain, gold I bring to crown him again. King forever, ceasing never, over us all to reign. Somehow God had communicated with these magi that this newborn king, this newborn baby was born to be a king, and the appropriate gift to give him was a gift of gold. And again, that is fitting. God had promised to David in 2 Samuel chapter 7 that he would establish out of his lineage an everlasting kingdom that would never end. Isaiah talks about this in Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6. When he gives this prophecy, for a child is born to us, a son is given to us, the government will be upon his shoulders, he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, notice that, Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace, and his government and its peace will never end. He will rule with fairness and justice over the throne of his ancestor David for all eternity. And how is this going to be accomplished? Because of the passionate commitment of the Lord of Heaven's armies, he will make all of this happen. The gift of gold. Just stop and think about how practical this gift would have been for Mary and Joseph. They had come to Bethlehem because of the census that was required. They would have had probably very little money. They were peasants from Nazareth, scraping by from day to day. And then they receive a message from God in a dream that they have to get out of Bethlehem because of Herod, and they are to escape to Egypt. Where would they have the wherewithal to go all the way to Egypt? And I believe it's very possible that the gift of gold was used to finance their trip to Egypt and even the time that they spent in Egypt before they returned to Nazareth. Notice the second gift that the Magi brought. Again, this was a God thing. It was a gift of frankincense. Why frankincense? Frankincense was a gift that you give to a priest, one who is going to be a priest. Listen to the third stanza of the Christmas carol. Frankincense to offer have I, incense owns a deity nigh. Prayer and praising, voices raising, worshiping God most high. What is frankincense? Frankincense is the incense that was burned in the great altar in Jerusalem. It was never to go out. And it was the job of the high priest to fill that ointment for continual incense so that it would continually burn. It was very costly. It provided a sweet smell. And it was offered to God as a symbol that our lives are to be a fragrant offering to God. So frankincense was a gift for a priest. And again, somehow God had communicated to these Magi that this was an appropriate gift to this newborn king, because he was born to be priest. The writer to the Hebrews brings that out so beautifully. Where is Jesus right now? He is at the right hand of God making intercession for us. He is our high priest. We don't need any other priest, because now we can come directly to God. And notice what it, Hebrews chapter 4 says. For since we have such a great high priest who has entered into the heavens, Jesus the Son of God, we can now hold firmly to what we believe. The high priest of ours understands our weaknesses, for he faced all the same testings we do, yet he did not sin. So now we can come boldly to the throne of our gracious God, and there we will receive mercy, and we will find grace to help us when we need it the most. And these Magi understood that. And that's why they brought the gift of frankincense. And notice the third gift that they brought, it was a gift of myrrh. And again, this is absolutely incredible. Fourth stanza of We Three Kings. Myrrh is mine, it's bitter perfume, breathes a breath, a breathes a life of gathering gloom, sorrowing, sighing, bleeding, dying, sealed in a stone cold tomb. What was myrrh? It was a burial ointment. It was a fragrant resin made from trees, and it was used to embalm bodies. When a person died in the New Testament era around Palestine, what they would do is they would take the corpse and they would wrap it with strips of linen. And they put the arms up and wrap it right up to under the arms, and then they would put the arms down and they would rewrap it. And all the while, they would put aloe and spices and myrrh to take away the smell of the decaying body. That's how they did it. And you talk about the most inappropriate gift that you could ever bring to a newborn child. It would be like going to a baby shower today and giving the baby a gift of a tombstone. You don't do that. Yet somehow God had communicated to these Magi that an appropriate gift to give to this king that was born was a gift of myrrh. Because Jesus was born to die. Jesus knew that. Over and over again in Matthew's gospel, three times he said, I must go to Jerusalem. I must suffer. I must be arrested. I must be handed over to the Roman authorities. I must die. But death will be conquered, because I will come back from the grave. That was the reason for which he came. Again, we read in Isaiah chapter 53 that this was prophesied hundreds of years before. Isaiah 53 says, "Yet it was our weaknesses he carried. It was our sorrows that weighed him down. And we thought his troubles were a punishment from God, a punishment for his own sins. But he was pierced for our rebellion, crushed for our sins. He was beaten so that we could be made whole. He was whipped so that we could be healed. All of us like sheep, we have gone astray. We have left God's paths to follow our own. Yet the Lord laid on him the sins of us all." And then it says in verse 9, "He was done no wrong. He never deceived anyone, but he was buried like a criminal. He was put in a rich man's grave." And Jesus fulfilled all of that when he died on the cross. It was God's plan for him. And that's why the gift of myrrh was given. And that's why at the end of his life, Jesus' last words from the cross were, "It is finished. The mission has been accomplished. There's no more that can be added to it. The sacrifice has been made." You know what I wonder? I wonder if some of the myrrh that the Magi brought was actually used at Jesus' burial. Just wonder things like that. Well, it says in verse 12, "When it was time to leave, they returned to their own country by another route, for God had warned them in a dream not to return to Herod." Isn't that interesting? That means they spent the night there because they had a dream. Maybe they even stayed at the house where Jesus was. Maybe they stayed at the inn. It wasn't full at that time in Bethlehem. But they stayed and they worshiped and they presented their gifts. And that's the quest of the Magi. I hope I haven't upset you by changing some of the wording. It should actually, could read, "We seven kings from Babylon are," but it doesn't sound as poetic. So let's still sing "We three kings," but I'll prefer to call it "The Quest of the Magi." Notice there are different responses. There was the response of Herod, which was hostility. He was so ticked off. How dare anybody absurd to him? And we still see people responding that way. Bah, humbug. I don't believe in the virgin birth. And then we see indifference. The religious leaders, the Magi had come all the way from the east, hundreds of miles, traveling for months. They had seen the star. You'd think the religious leaders would have taken the time to go to Bethlehem. It's only a couple miles down the road. But no, they were too busy. It was ho-hum. Who cares? Indifference. And again, that's a response that we see of many people today. But what was the response of the Magi? It says when they entered the house, they were filled with joy. And they presented those costly gifts to the one who was born to be king. And I just encourage you to go on that quest. Some of you have heard of Lee Strobel. Lee Strobel has written a number of books, including The Case for Faith, The Case for Christ. He was a journalist, an atheist. And one day his wife came home and said she had become a Christian, and he was really mad. And he went out to disprove the message of Christianity and disprove the resurrection of Jesus. And guess what? He couldn't. And finally, kicking and screaming, because he did take time to examine the evidence, he committed his life to Christ. Maybe you need to go on a quest.